A big mistake today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump offers this explanation for Iran shooting down a U.S. drone.
I think probably Iran made a mistake. I would imagine it was a general or somebody that made a mistake in shooting that drone down.
But inside Iran, consensus is that the U.S. is the aggressor.
What Trump has done is that he has united the Iranian population more than I've ever seen in the last three decades.
Tensions with Iran ahead this hour, plus a rare whale and a rare recording of its song.
We suspected it was a right whale because they make a gunshot sound.
Those stories ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Trump says Iran made a very big mistake by shooting down a U.S. drone. That was his first response via Twitter. He elaborated later, talking to reporters at the White House.
I find it hard to believe it was intentional, if you want to know the truth. I think that it could have been somebody who was loose and stupid that did it. But we'll be able to report back, and you'll understand exactly what happened. But it was a very foolish move. That I can tell you.
Asked if he was willing to go to war with Iran, Trump said, "You'll find out." But he did remind his audience that he campaigned on the promise of no more endless wars. At the Pentagon, reporters there got a briefing by phone from Lieutenant General Joseph Gastella, the top Air Force commander in the Middle East. He blamed any escalation of tensions in the region squarely on Iran.
This dangerous and escalatory attack was irresponsible and occurred in the vicinity of established air corridors between Dubai, UAE, and Muscat, Oman, possibly endangering innocent civilians.
Iran claims it shot down the drone after it flew into Iranian airspace. Washington says the drone was in international airspace. Robert Ford is a former U.S. diplomat who served as ambassador to Syria and Algeria. He's now a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. Ambassador Ford, do you agree with President Trump's guess that this attack on a U.S. drone was some sort of mistake?
I think it's possible that the missile was fired without the person who hit the button checking with the top command in Tehran. I think that's possible. The Iranians are certainly in a state of high alert, and people could be a little jumpy. The question is, how then to de-escalate?
Do you think President Trump's referring to this as a possible mistake is a way for him to de-escalate the situation?
I think it might be. I certainly don't think the president wants to get involved in a big war in the Middle East. I don't think the American public wants to get involved in a big war in the Middle East. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who think a sharp, limited military strike would best restore deterrence, and my guess is the president is trying to figure that out right now.
What do you think of that option? Do you think a short, precise military strike is something he should consider?
I think you should always consider different options when a country as important as Iran in a region as important as the Middle East is acting in a destabilizing manner. But that said, it seems to me that the Iranians are playing a long game, not a short game, which means that a single American strike might give the Iranians pause for a week or 2 weeks, but then they will again be pushing and testing the edge of the American envelope.
What can or should the U.S. do in response to the downing of the U.S. drone? I mean, what are the realistic options?
The realistic options are, as I mentioned, short, sharp strike. But at the same time, the problem with that is that the Iranians don't have a way out. And the Americans are going to start needing to think of positive incentives to the Iranians. All of the incentives from the United States towards Iran since Trump came into office have been negative incentives. And it's not having the desired effect of bringing the Iranians to the negotiating table. The Americans keep emphasizing they want a negotiation, but they are providing no positive incentives. They need to show the Iranians what steps the Americans might take if the Iranians were willing to negotiate. We have not heard that from Washington.
In your experience as a diplomat, are we at a point in this crisis that it could lead to war?
I don't think the United States or Iran wants a prolonged, every day there are strikes by each side against the other side kind of war. I think instead what we're likely to see is a series of tit-for-tat measures taken back and forth between Washington and Tehran, perhaps involving military assets in places like the Persian Gulf or Iraq or Syria or even Lebanon, which for the United States is a problem. That itself is destabilizing. So the real question is how to open up a reliable channel of communication to ensure that any step the Americans take in terms of a short, sharp military strike is accompanied by a message to Iran which says, we want to do this, but we don't want to do more. Here are steps you need to take, and here are steps we are willing to take.
You mentioned that a short strategic military strike is probably one option that the Trump administration may be considering or at least discussing as a possibility. If you were a betting man, how would you rate the odds of a U.S. military retaliation at this point?
Well, I'm not a betting man, so I don't want to give you odds. I think that the Iranians are absolutely testing the edge of the American envelope. There probably is going to be a time when they do go over an American red line, especially if they kill an American service member, or frankly, I think even if they were to kill American civilians in some kind of terror attack somewhere. But they're testing our red lines, and so sooner or later, I think they are trying to provoke the Americans. It's a difficult undertaking to clearly identify the other side's red lines. We, too, need to understand the Iranian red lines.
Why is Iran trying to provoke the U.S.?
Two reasons. Number one, they believe that they have a certain place in the Middle East itself for historic, cultural reasons, etc. They think the Americans are trying to deny them that place. And second, the American sanctions have caused real pain inside Iran. And what better way to rally support among a larger proportion of the population than to be confronting a big, nasty outside enemy and you're the underdog? So they have a domestic political reason, and they have a historic geopolitical, geostrategic reason.
Robert Ford is a former U.S. diplomat who served as ambassador to Syria and Algeria. He's now a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and a professor of global affairs at Yale. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure.
As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. accuses Iran of shooting down the American drone in international airspace. Tehran claims the aircraft violated its airspace. Iranian officials are painting Washington as the aggressor here, and they argue that President Trump's aggressive stance only stiffens the resolve of the Iranian people.
What Trump has done is that he has united the Iranian population more than I've ever seen in the last three decades.
That's Syed Mohammad Mirandi in Iran's capital. He's a professor at the University of Tehran.
By downing the drone, Iran is protecting its sovereignty. If it was an Iranian drone flying over U.S. territory, I think that the United States would be utterly outraged. So the United States thinks that it has special privileges, that it can violate the sovereignty of other countries and get away with it. And if countries defend themselves, then they are behaving outrageously. If a drone enters Iranian airspace, that is an act of aggression, and Iran will defend itself, especially when the United States repeatedly says all options are on the table.
Well,
this is the behavior of an empire.
Again, the U.S. Central Command, they did confirm that the drone was shot down, but they said it was an international airspace. The other point, though, is it clearly escalates tensions.
The problem is that the United States is escalating tension. The United States is waging economic warfare on ordinary Iranians, on Iranian women and children. It's trying to terrorize the Iranian population through brutal sanctions, what Trump calls brutal sanctions. And the United States, on the other hand, it's constantly threatening Iran. The U.S. president threatened to annihilate Iran as a country. And on the other hand, despite the fact that Western countries have been violating the nuclear agreement, the Iranians over the last year have continued to abide by their commitments.
But I don't think the Trump administration is out to annihilate Iran.
Threatening to annihilate Iran, that is a very serious statement. Whether that is the intention or not, that is a disgusting statement for any individual to make.
Now, there's this tit for tat, which is just getting more and more serious. What is the end game for Iran? I mean, how far will Iran go?
The end game for Iran is clear. Iran wants to defend its sovereignty. Iran wants the United States to respect its sovereignty. And if the United States were to abide by its commitments within the framework of the nuclear deal, then we would not be where we are today.
At this point, it's not entirely clear who's provoking who in this situation. In terms of Iranian citizens, are they taking steps to prepare for a conflict? I mean, do you see people sort of stockpiling goods or taking extra steps because of the uncertainty of the relationship right now and the tension between the U.S. and Iran?
No, I haven't seen that. And I think one reason is that people in Iran believe that the United States is not going to engage in war with Iran because they do recognize that it is an unwinnable war and that the oil and gas facilities in the Persian Gulf region will be destroyed in the crossfire and that that will lead to a global economic catastrophe. And the United States will be driven out of Iraq and other areas in the region. This would be catastrophic for everyone, but the United States will not win. So I think people in Iran believe that there are enough sane people in the United States to prevent people like Bolton and Pompeo from getting their way from what we see. But we'll have to wait and see.
You're referring, of course, to John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. Now, when all is said and done, leaders in Washington and Tehran are somewhat boxed into a corner at this point. I mean, the options for both sides are limited. Escalate the tensions further, a very dangerous move, or back down. Is that how you see it?
That is what the Americans have done. The Americans have moved forward in a way where they have no exit strategy. You cannot expect a nation to give up its sovereignty in the face of such aggression. The United States has shown the international community that it has no respect for its commitments. And this is not only true with Iran, it's true with other countries as well.
Who might Iran accept as a mediator at this point to prevent an all-out war?
I don't think that Iran sees mediation as necessary. The Iranians are saying that we have signed a nuclear deal with the United States and other countries, the Russians, the British, the Germans, and the French and the Chinese. And this deal was the result of a decade of negotiations. And Iran gave concessions in order to reach this agreement. So the United States is the one that has left the table. They have stopped cooperating. They are engaging in economic warfare, and they have left the negotiations. So it's clear if the Americans want the situation to normalize, then they must abide by the commitments that they have made before. There was no revolution in the United States in 2016. The Trump government cannot say that previous regimes were illegitimate in the United States. Those were commitments that the United States made, and those are the commitments that the United States must abide by.
Syed Mohammad Mirandi is a professor at the University of Tehran. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The lead UN investigator on the Khashoggi murder explains why she believes the Saudi state is responsible. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The United Nations issued a report this week on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and it was uncomfortable reading for the rulers of Saudi Arabia. The report said the Saudi state is responsible for Khashoggi's death and that there is credible evidence linking Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the killing, evidence that should be investigated further. Agnes Kalmar headed the UN probe. She's the special rapporteur on extrajudicial executions based in Geneva, Switzerland. The World's Shirin Jafar spoke with Kalmar about her report's findings and recommendations.
Ms. Kalmar, it took 5 months to come up with this report and the conclusion that the Saudi state had a direct hand in Khashoggi's murder. How does it feel now that the report has been published?
I think it's a relief that I was able to put the findings and the conclusions in the public domain. I'm welcoming constructive dialogues with everyone concerned in and by the report.
Now, through this investigation, you had access to material and specifically audio recordings from the day before and the day of Khashoggi's murder inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey. What were some of the new details that you learned listening to these tapes that we didn't know before?
What I have been able to ascertain on the basis of the recording is the fact that very early on, immediately after Mr. Khashoggi left the consulate on the 28th of September, already there were communications between the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and Riyadh in Saudi Arabia regarding his visit and the fact that a special operation mission should be put into place. There were a number of discussions demonstrating planning and preparation. There were discussions regarding the individuals that may be of use for the mission, who they could be, what kind of skills were required of them. There was a discussion just before Mr. Khashoggi returned around 2 o'clock on the 2nd of October, where the forensic medical doctor talked in very clear details about the dismemberment of a body and the arrival of Mr. Khashoggi in the consulate was greeted with the words, "The sacrificial animal has arrived." So all of those items, I do not know whether they were new to everyone, but I have certainly made them public and available.
And you make this conclusion that, you know, listening to all that and learning about all this information sort of shows that this was a premeditated murder.
Yes. On the basis of the information available, there is no doubt that a mission, a special operation mission, was planned against Mr. Khashoggi. There is also no doubt in my mind that murder was part of the plan. What I have not been able to ascertain is whether murder was the only objective of the mission or whether it was a secondary objective if and in case the kidnapping or abduction was not possible.
And what did you learn about Jamal Khashoggi as a man? We know him as a, you know, well-known columnist, but as a fellow human being, what did you learn about him?
I think Mr. Khashoggi was a very complex person. He lived a compartmentalized life. He had certain friends to whom he communicated certain things. I think he was somebody who, by the time he was in Washington, D.C., was feeling lonely, was experiencing loneliness. He missed his country. He missed his family. He was worried about the future of him, for himself and for his country. He was also someone whose political journey was in construction. You know, he didn't, his own personal growth politically towards democracy, press freedom, and human rights took different steps, and he imposed exile on himself because he had determined he could no longer stay in Saudi Arabia. So I think he was somebody extremely interesting to observe, as far as I can say, in that fashion, and to try to understand.
Now, moving on to what the U.S. knew, you said there's insufficient evidence to suggest that Turkey or the U.S. knew or could have foreseen the threat to Khashoggi. But you did cite reports that U.S. intelligence agencies had intercepted communications between Saudi officials discussing plans to abduct Khashoggi. Could U.S. intelligence agencies have done more to prevent this?
Based on my standard for the assessment of evidence, it is not possible for me to conclude that the United States or Turkey knew of the threats against Mr. Khashoggi. I cannot rely on a media report and on leaks.
At least one U.S. official, CIA Director Gina Haspel, also listened to these tapes. Did you talk with her or anyone in the CIA about what they made of these tapes?
No.
Why was that?
Well, the CIA appears to have very strict regulation regarding who they speak with and who they don't speak with.
But you made a request?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
What are your lingering questions, questions that you weren't able to answer?
You know, the questions I was not able to answer are questions that I'm suggesting be the object of a follow-up investigation. My inquiry is a human rights inquiry. It focuses on the responsibilities of the state. In that context, identified individual evidence related to the individual responsibilities, but it is neither my role nor my mandate to reach a conclusion, and therefore I have recommended that the Secretary General appoints a panel of experts to investigate the individual criminal liability of people involved in the killings, including high-level officials. And I do still have a number of questions as far as the extent and the nature of their responsibilities for the killing.
Agnès Callamard is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
That was the world's Shirin Jafari speaking with Agnès Callamard. Just a quick note before the break to tell you about a story we have for you online. It's about the Yazidi community in northern Iraq. For many Yazidis, the experience of being forced from their land by ISIS is still painful. The UN says only a tiny percentage of them will attempt to return home in the coming year. But 25-year-old Sakvan Suleiman Hussein has already made the trip home near Sinjar in northern Iraq. And now he's trying to rebuild his family's vegetable farm. Read his story exclusively at the world.org. I'm Carol Hills. When Congresswoman Ilhan Omar speaks about refugees and their future, she's speaking from personal experience.
I think often a lot about the little Ilhans in refugee camps who are asking their families, why is it taking so long for their applications to be processed?
Ilhan Omar on World Refugee Day, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Today is World Refugee Day, and it started out with tension, more tension, between the U.S. and Iran. President Trump says Iran made a big mistake shooting down an American drone. It's concerning because of the possibility of a military conflict between Washington and Tehran. Wars are a big reason why people flee their homes and become refugees. Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar knows this on a personal level. The World's Monica Campbell spoke with her earlier today.
I wanted to speak with you about the refugee crisis and immigration in the U.S. But first, the drone attack is top of the news today, and you sit on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Should the U.S. respond, and how?
I think it's too new, and so I will reserve comments on that. We have an opportunity to get a briefing in a little bit. As you probably know, I am one to never be interested in engaging in warfare. As a veteran once told me, boots on the ground means boots in the grave. And as a survivor of war, I gravely understand that more than anyone else. And we want to make sure that we're not getting ourselves in another endless war. We have opportunities. We have tools in our toolbox. And we're at a position, I think, to explore what other tools we can use that are not going to cause the deaths of Americans and the deaths of Iranians and others in the Middle East.
For now, I would like to return back to the refugee and immigration story. Trump is threatening to deport millions of undocumented immigrants starting next week. He and the acting director of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, are sending a message to families in parts of Central America not to come. And some say that's not an easy option for some families. Where do you stand on this?
We have to look at our immigration process through a humane lens. And what this administration is doing really is truly inhumane. It's extremely un-American, and it goes against our values. We're talking about people who are coming to our border seeking asylum, and there's nothing illegal about seeking an asylum. And so we have an opportunity to use the resources that we have to properly process people. And we have an administration that is hell-bent on making people seem as if they are breaking laws when they are just within the borders of what is allowed by international law.
And you're a refugee yourself from Somalia. How does your personal experience shape your views on how the U.S. is handling migrants at the border?
I mean, I you know, today is World Refugee Day. Yesterday, I had an opportunity to have some refugees in my office. And we were talking about, you know, the initial countries we all entered once we fled our own countries. So my story began leaving my home country of Somalia and going into the borders of Kenya. And we were processed and we were welcomed. We were given an opportunity to make our case for refugee asylum and eventually got the opportunity to come to the United States. To me, when I look at what is happening in our border, what's happening with the refugee resettlement program, when I look at what's happening with our family reunification program, this is an administration really that isn't interested in making sure that we have an immigration process that is humane. They are truly interested in limiting certain people from coming into this country.
Some people call refugees who arrive to the U.S. some of the most vetted people in the world.
Exactly.
Just to go back to the border, your congressional colleague, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is getting a lot of heat, being called anti-Semitic by some after she called migrant facilities, quote, concentration camps. Do you agree with her description?
I mean, when you look at what is taking place, people are being put in camps. And when you think about the definition, if we separate it from death camps, I would say these are camps and people are being concentrated in them. And so that's the general definition. I think a lot of people are conflating what a death camp looks like or a specific removal of people and being put in camps. These people are coming to the border. We are removing them from the border. We are placing them in camps. Some of them are being removed from communities and being put in what we're calling detention centers, but essentially camps. Freezers, they're being put in. Dog cages.
Well, what they call dog cages and what they call freezers.
There has to be a way for us to have this conversation without calling people names and accusing them of things when they are just having a general, honest conversation on how detrimental this is. When you talk about the process of dehumanizing people so that you can exterminate them, there is a process. And when you are constantly engaging in the kind of rhetoric this administration has engaged in when it comes to immigrants and people who are seeking asylum and refugees, we have to be alarmed. It is very worrisome. And when we say never again, that means we have to be vigilant that doesn't happen under our watch as we stay politically correct and try to find the proper words to use or even worse, look the other way.
Finally, going back to today, World Refugee Day, do you think you and your family would have been allowed in the United States today in this time?
That's a really difficult question and a sad one to contemplate. I know that as the numbers dwindle every year under this administration, it becomes very hard for a lot of refugees to still have that dream of being relocated into the United States, and I think often a lot about the little Ilhans in refugee camps who are asking their families, why is it taking so long for their applications to be processed? And I hope that we understand the kind of opportunities we can give to the 8-year-olds that are waiting for a chance to be in a classroom, for a chance to play in a playground, for a chance to really dream about a future of maybe even being in Congress one day.
Congresswoman Ilhan Omar in Washington, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Representative Omar was speaking there with the world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. The UN says there was a record number of displaced people around the globe last year, more than 70 million forced to flee war, other types of violence, and persecution. At the same time, the U.S. has drastically cut the number of refugees it's resettling here. Monica recently revisited a family of refugees from Syria. They're now in California to see how changes in U.S. policy are affecting their lives.
When I first met Wajid Al Khalifa and her family in 2015, they were just getting their bearings in the city of Turlock. It's in a rural part of California, about 2 hours east of San Francisco. But soon there were milestones. Wajid and her husband, Yasim, got driver's licenses, and their 4 kids moved up in school. It was a big change after fleeing war in Syria and arriving to the U.S. as refugees. So it was time for another visit.
Yes, yes, is that Mohammed?
Their son, Mohammed, has sprouted up. He's 5 years old, and he's got this little blue suit on today. Yasim, the dad, he's picking up more English.
I go to my kids' school, I talk to the teacher. Every day I'm learning something different.
And Wajid just started learning English at home. She says a woman comes to the house and tutors. And Yasim, he's 38, he still works at a halal slaughterhouse. It's tough, messy, physical work, similar to what he did in Syria. But now Yasim is pretty much supervising the place and earning more.
Right now I make $16.
$16 an hour now?
Yes.
From 9?
From 9, yeah. My boss said, inshallah, like 3-4 months, he make me more.
They're also renting a home now instead of a cramped apartment. But the biggest milestone is a new child.
I have one girl, American citizen right here. Oh, yeah, she's sleeping right now.
I know. Yesterday she turned 1 year old.
But some things are stuck, and they might be for a while. The last time we were here, you were worried about your family in Syria.
Yeah. My brother and his wife and his children.
Your older brother?
Yeah.
Where is he? Is he in Jordan?
In Jordan. He wait for something different, or Trump change his brain.
Here's what happened. Yasim's older brother was about to be resettled in the U.S. too. It was 2017, and he had his plane ticket ready. And then President Trump's travel ban blocked Syrian refugees from the U.S., along with refugees from other countries. His brother's son did make it to the U.S. just 1 month before Trump took office. So one person got in and the other didn't, split by a shift in policies.
My nephew come in and my brother no come.
It's not what was planned.
No. This is not fair.
The shift is rooted in the Trump administration's stricter position on immigrants overall, and refugees, particularly from predominantly Muslim countries. This year, the U.S. cap on refugees is 30,000, down from 45,000 last year, already a historic low.
And that really speaks to, what does this say about America then? Because the U.S. has always been the global leader in providing this type of humanitarian aid.
Karen Ferguson is with the International Rescue Committee in Northern California. It's an international NGO that assists refugees. She's looking to other countries for inspiration.
The country that, you know, I enjoy looking at right now is Canada. So they stepped up actually even more than the United States did in terms of trying to respond to the Syrian crisis. And they have not stepped away in the same way that the United States has.
the largest number of refugees to the U.S. are coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Myanmar, and Ukraine. In terms of Syrians, the U.S. has taken in about 350 so far this year, compared to 12,000 in 2016. In California, Yasim and his wife Wajid are feeling more rooted in the U.S. Wajid says she feels freer here and her kids are learning more. Yasim says there's no home to go back to in Syria anyway. He shows me a video someone just sent him recently of his old neighborhood in Homs, still in ruins.
Like this area for my family, me and my brother, my sister.
That was your house, rubble.
Rubble.
Yasim can't imagine going back. He's lost four brothers to the war in Syria. Now, his hope is that his surviving brother, displaced in Jordan, can eventually join him in the U.S., but he's unsure when or if that will happen. For The World, Monica Campbell, Turlock, California.
Okay, listen carefully to this and try to guess what it is. It's hard, right? Well, that was the sound made by one of the rarest whales on Earth, the North Pacific right whale. To be fair, it took marine biologists nearly 8 years to figure that out. Here's marine biologist Jessica Krantz. She's with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So we first heard this strange pattern sounds in 2010 during one of our field surveys in the Bering Sea, but we never were able to officially confirm that it came from right whales. And then we were back out at sea in 2017, and using a special instrument called a sonobuoy, we were able to confirm that right whale was, in fact, producing this song. It does sound very different from what most people think of as songs. They're comprised almost entirely of one call type, like you're playing a drum almost. Their songs sound very different from what you normally think of when you hear whale song, like a humpback whale. They are called the right whale because they were the right whale to kill, because they're slow, they're very fat and oily, and they float when they're killed. These animals are very rare. They are what we call critically endangered. They became the target of extensive whaling in the 1800s. And then in the 1960s, the Soviets began hunting North Pacific right whales illegally. And our best guess right now is that there are only about 30 animals left in the eastern population. For me, it was really exciting to finally get that last piece of the puzzle and to finally be able to say, yes, this was a right whale. Yes, it was a male. And yes, they are singing.
Marine biologist Jessica Krantz with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, talking about the unique songs of rare North Pacific right whales. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in Washington today. His goal is to convince the U.S. to ratify the new North American trade agreement quickly. But back in Canada, Trudeau faces a political and economic controversy over a new pipeline to move tar sands oil from Alberta to ports on the Pacific coast. The pipeline has faced a slew of legal and political challenges, not least from the country's Native or First Nations groups, but many First Nations groups are now on board. Delbert Wapas is the former chief of the Thunder Child First Nation in Saskatchewan, and now he heads a group that wants to buy the pipeline. Mr. Wapas, why do you support the project so much that you think it should actually be owned by First Nations people?
Well, I support economic development. When, as a former chief of my community, of my First Nation, I witnessed firsthand the pressures that were there, the crisis, you know, the poverty that many First Nations face. So it's incumbent upon First Nations or Indigenous peoples to engage and to be invited, you know, to participate in such a business opportunity. But, yeah.
Let's get to the economic benefits. If your community was able to buy this pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, what kind of economic benefit is there?
Well, the money is going to come from the shippers, you know, the 13 shippers that have You know, they're 20-year agreements. Their oil will be going through our pipeline.
What about the issue of sacred lands? The Trans Mountain Pipeline is going to go through some sacred sites of First Nations. What kind of assurances have you gotten that the pipeline won't harm things like waterways and sacred lands?
Well, I think technology today is a lot better than what it was back in the day. And there's no 100% guarantee on anything. In any business, there's risks, right? But how can we ensure that we are positioned to deal with any mishap or anything that goes? That's just responsible business practices, you know, so no different here.
In the same week that Justin Trudeau reapproved this tar sands oil pipeline, the Canadian government also declared a climate emergency. And of course, that crisis is largely driven by burning oil and other fossil fuels. So how do you square the two, feeling the effects of a climate crisis while supporting more fossil fuels?
Well, in First Nations country, we're very mindful, we're very cognizant of that. The reality, though, is that unless we change the economics within our communities, you know, to get to the starting point of engaging at the level of climate change, we're already doing our part. In anything that we do as First Nations people, we get involved in business from a responsibility perspective. It's not just an interest. This would be no different. So once we're able to position ourselves, you know, to get into alternative energy, into, you know, other means, we can't even have that discussion right now. So how do we change that narrative to ensure, you know, that we're part of that discussion?
So you see economic growth as a way for First Nation communities to be at the table and take a stronger role on things like climate change?
Exactly.
There's such a focus on climate change now and on reducing carbon footprint. Are you concerned at all that you could buy this pipeline, your First Nation community could buy the pipeline, have this big asset that then totally loses its value as Canada cuts its use of fossil fuels?
The fact is that the market continues to need oil. I'm very hopeful, though, that in a future, not so distant future, that, you know, there will be a change, and there will be inventions that is going to assist the acknowledgement and the support of climate change. But until that happens, this investment means that First Nations can work towards developing something that is going to help and support climate change.
How close are you to raising the money?
We've been meeting with banks, and we like what we're hearing and where things are at in regards to it.
Dalbert Wapas is a former chief of the Thunderchild First Nation community in Canada, and he's the founder of a group that hopes to buy the proposed Trans Mountain oil pipeline to benefit First Nations groups. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Finally today, a global battle of the beatboxers, duking it out on a new project called Stereonosis. Let's start off by meeting one of the musicians, Russian beatboxer Pash.
I don't remember the day that I don't did the beatbox. 15 years every day. For me, a lot of beatboxers try to copy and buy different beatboxers. It's like you spend your energy for copy other beatboxers. This is not right for me. Spend your energy for create something new, not to copy.
The beatboxers on the album come from Russia, Japan, and the U.S. Their hard-driving beats are combined with more traditional melodies played by musicians from Africa and the Middle East. And pulling it all together took a lot of time and effort. That was Patrick Archie's job. He started producing the album years ago from his home in Montana.
I scouted 10 master musicians who spoke 9 different languages, and I did that largely just watching YouTube for years and years. Arguably, the scouting process for this album happened over as many as 10 years. But I would email these musicians directly and explain who I was and the vision of the project. And these are the 10 musicians that basically responded with a lot of enthusiasm, and they definitely, they could feel the vision of the project.
Then came an even bigger challenge, getting everyone together in one place to record, which Archie was able to do in a studio in Stockholm.
I just described that I was very inspired by their work and that I was working on a music project that was, we were trying to promote cross-cultural dialogue and reach out to musicians in a lot of different countries and combine beatboxing with musical elements and present it to a broader audience.
The result? Stereonosis. We leave you with another track from the album. It's called Stars. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.